Chapter 6. The Crew. 19. Gladia stood on the soil of Solaria. She smelled the vegetation, not quite the odors of Aurora, and at once she crossed the gap of 20 decades. Nothing, she knew, could bring back associations in the way that odors could. Not sights, not sounds. Just that faint, unique smell brought back childhood. The freedom of running about, with a dozen robots watching her carefully. The excitement of seeing other children sometimes. Coming to a halt, staring shyly, approaching one another a half step at a time, reaching out to touch, and then a robot saying, "Enough, Miss Gladia," and being led away, looking over the shoulder at the other child, with whom there was another set of attendant robots in charge. She remembered the day that she was told that only by holovision would she see other human beings thereafter. Viewing, she was told, not seeing. The robot said seeing, as though it were a word they must not say, so that they had to whisper it. She could see them, but they were not human. It was not so bad at first. The images she could talk to were three-dimensional, free-moving. They could talk, run, turn cartwheels if they wished, but they could not be felt. And then she was told that she could actually see someone whom she had often viewed and whom she had liked. He was a grown man, quite a bit older than she was, though he looked quite young, as one did on Solaria. She would have permission to continue to see him, if she wished, whenever necessary. She wished. She remembered how it was, exactly how it was on that first day. She was tongue-tied, and so was he. They circled each other, afraid to touch. But it was marriage. Of course it was. And then they met again, seeing, not viewing, because it was marriage. They would finally touch each other. They were supposed to. It was the most exciting day of her life. Until it took place. Fiercely, Gladia stopped her thoughts. Of what used to go on? She so warm and eager, he so cold and withdrawn. He continued to be cold. When he came to see her at fixed intervals for the rites that might or might not succeed in impregnating her, it was with such clear revulsion that she was soon longing for him to forget. But he was a man of duty, and he never forgot. Then came the time, years of dragging unhappiness later, when she found him dead, his skull crushed, and herself as the only possible suspect. Elijah Bailey had saved her then, and she had been taken away from Solaria and sent to Aurora. Now she was back, smelling Solaria. Nothing else was familiar. The house in the distance bore no resemblance to anything she remembered even faintly. In 20 decades it had been modified, torn down, rebuilt. She could not even gain any sense of familiarity with the ground itself. She found herself reaching backward to touch the settler ship that had brought her to this world that smelled like home, but was home in no other way, just to touch something that was familiar by comparison. Daniil, who stood next to her in the shadow of the ship, said, "Do you see the robots, Madame Gladia?" There were a group of them 100 yards away, amid the trees of an orchard, watching solemnly, motionlessly, shining in the sun with a grayish, well-polished metal finish Gladia remembered Solarian robots to have. She said, "I do, Daniil."
"Is there anything familiar about them, madam?"
"Not at all. They seem to be new models. I can't remember them, and I'm sure they can't remember me. If D.G. was expecting anything hopeful to come of my supposed familiarity with the robots on my estate, he will have to be disappointed." Giscard said, "They do not seem to be doing anything, madam." Gladia said, "That is understandable. We're intruders, and they've come to observe us and to report on us in accordance with what must be standing orders. They have no one now to report to, however, and can merely silently observe. Without further orders, I presume they will do no more than that, but they won't cease doing so, either."
Daniil said, "It might be well, Madame Gladia, if we retired to our quarters on board ship. The captain is, I believe, supervising the construction of defenses, and is not ready to go exploring yet. I suspect he will not approve your having left your quarters without his specific permission."
Gladia said haughtily,
I'm not going to delay stepping out onto the surface of my own world just to suit his whim.
I understand, but members of the crew are engaged in the vicinity, and I believe that some note your presence here.
And are approaching, said Giscard. If you would avoid infection...
I'm prepared, said Gladia. Nose plugs and gloves.
Gladia did not understand the nature of the structures being put up on the flat ground about the ship. For the most part, the crewmen, absorbed in the construction, had not seen Gladia and her two companions, standing as they were in the shadows. It was the warm season on this portion of Solaria, which had a tendency to grow warmer, and on other occasions colder, than Aurora did, since the Solarian day was nearly 6 hours longer than the Auroran day. The crewmen approaching were five in number, and one of them, the tallest and largest, pointed in the direction of Gladia. The other four looked, remained standing for a while as though merely curious, and then, at a gesture from the first, approached again, changing their angle slightly so as to head directly for the Auroran three. Gladia watched them silently, and with her eyebrows raised in contempt. Daniil and Giscard waited impassively. Giscard said in a low voice to Daniil, "I do not know where the captain is. I cannot distinguish him from the crowd of crewmen in whose midst he must be."
"Shall we retire?" said Daniil aloud.
"That would be disgraceful," said Gladia. "This is my world." She held her ground, and the five crewmen came closer in leisurely fashion. They had been working, doing hard physical labor. Like robots, thought Gladia with disdain, and they were sweating. Gladia became aware of the odor that reeked from them. That would have served to force her away more than threats would, but she held her ground even so. The nose plug, she was sure, mitigated the effect of the smell. The large crewman approached more closely than the others. His skin was bronzed. His bare arms glistened with moisture and with shining musculature. He might be 30, as near as Gladia could judge the age of these short-lived beings, and if he were washed and properly dressed, he might prove quite presentable. He said,
"So, you are the spacer lady from Aurora that we've been carrying on our ship."
He spoke rather slowly, obviously trying to attain an aristocratic tinge to his galactic. He failed, of course, and he spoke like a settler, even more crudely than D.G. did. Gladia said, establishing her territorial rights, "I am from Solaria, settler," and stopped in confused embarrassment. She had spent so much time thinking of Solaria just now that 20 decades had dropped away, and she had spoken with a thick Solarian accent. There was the broad A in Solaria and the rough R, while the I sounded horribly like oi. She said again in a much lower, less commanding voice, but one in which the accent of Aurora University, the standard for galactic speech through all the spacer worlds, rang clear. "I am from Solaria, settler." The settler laughed and turned to the others.
"She speaks la-di-da, but she had to try, right, mates?"
The others laughed, too, and one cried out,
"Get her to talk some more, Ness. Maybe we can all learn to talk like spacer birdies."
And he placed one hand on his hip, in as dainty a manner as he could manage, while holding the other hand out limply. Ness said, still smiling,
"Shut up, all of you."
There was instant silence. He turned to Gladia again.
"I'm Berto Ness, first-class shipper. And your name, little woman?"
Gladia did not venture to speak again. Ness said,
"I'm being polite, little woman. I'm speaking gentlemanly, spacer-like. I know you're old enough to be my great-grandmother. How old are you, little woman?"
400,
shouted one of the crewmen from behind Ness.
"But she doesn't look it." "She doesn't look 100,
said another.
"She looks suitable for a little ding-donging," said a third, "and hasn't had any for a long time, I guess. Ask her if she'd want some, Ness. Be polite and ask if we can take turns."
Gladia flushed angrily, and Daniil said, "First-class shipper Ness, your companions are offending, Madam Gladia. Would you retire?" Ness turned to look at Daniil, whom till now he had totally ignored. The smile vanished from his face, and he said,
"Look, you. This little lady is off-limits. The captain said so. We won't bother her. Just a little harmless talk. That thing there is a robot. We won't bother with him, and he can't hurt us. We know the three laws of robotics. We order him to stay away from us, see? But you are a spacer, and the captain has given us no orders about you. So you, he pointed a finger, stay out of this and don't interfere, or you'll get your pretty skin all bruised up, and then you might cry.
Daniil said nothing. Nis nodded his head.
Good. I like to see someone smart enough not to start anything he can't finish.
He turned to Gladia.
Now, little spacer woman, we will leave you alone, because the captain doesn't want you bothered. If one of the men here made a crude remark, that's only natural. Just shake hands and let's be friends. Spacer, settler, what's the difference?
He thrust out his hand toward Gladia, who shrank away in horror. Daniil's hand moved outward in a flick that was almost too fast to see, and caught Nis's wrist. First-class shipper Nis, he said quietly. Do not attempt to touch the lady. Nis looked down at his hand and at the fingers that enclosed his wrist firmly. He said in a low and menacing growl,
You have to the count of three to let go.
Daniil's hand fell away. He said,
I must do as you say, for I do not wish to harm you, but I must protect the lady. And if she doesn't wish to be touched, as I believe she doesn't, I may be forced into a position where I must cause you pain. Please accept my assurance that I will do all I can to minimize that.
One of the crewmen shouted joyously,
Give it to him, Nis! He's a talker!
Nis said,
Look, spacer, twice I told you to keep out and you touched me once. Now I tell you a third time and that's it. Make a move, say a word, and I take you apart. This little woman is going to shake hands, that's all, friendly-like. Then we all go, fair enough?
Gladia said in a low, choking voice, I won't be touched by him. Do what is necessary. Daniil said,
Sir, with all due respect, the lady does not wish to be touched. I must ask you, all of you, to leave.
Nis smiled, and one large arm moved as though to brush Daniil to one side, and to do it hard. Daniil's left arm flickered, and once again Nis was held by the wrist.
"'Please go, sir,' said Daniil.
Nis's teeth continued to show, but he was no longer smiling. Violently he brought his arm up. Daniil's enclosing hand moved up for a short distance, slowed, and came to a halt. His face showed no strain. His hand moved down, dragging Nis's arm with it, and then, with a rapid twist, he bent Nis's arm behind the settler's broad back and held it there. Nis, who found himself unexpectedly with his back to Daniil, brought his other arm up and over his head, groping for Daniil's neck. His other wrist was seized and pulled down farther than it could easily go, and Nis grunted in clear misery. The other four crewmen, who had been watching in eager anticipation, remained in place now, motionless, silent, mouths open. Nis, staring at them, grunted,
Help me!
Daniil said, They will not help you, sir, for the captain's punishment will be all the worse if they try. I must ask you now to assure me that you will no longer trouble Madame Gladia, and that you will leave quietly, all of you. Otherwise I very much regret, first-class shipper, that I must pull your arms out of their sockets. As he said that, he tightened his grip on either wrist, and Nis emitted a muffled grunt.
My apologies, sir, said Daniil, but I am under the strictest orders. May I have your assurance?
Nis kicked backward with sudden viciousness, but well before his heavy boot could make contact, Daniil had faded to one side and pulled him off balance. He went face down heavily.
May I have your assurance, sir?
Said Daniil, now pulling gently at the two wrists, so that the crewman's arms lifted slightly up from the back. Nis howled and said, half incoherent,
I give in! Let go!
Daniil let go at once and stepped back. Slowly and painfully, Nis rolled over, moving his arms slowly and rotating his wrists with a twisted grimace. Then, when his right arm moved near the holster he wore, he snatched clumsily at his sidearm. Daniil's foot came down on his hand and pinned it to the ground.
Don't do that, sir, or I may be forced to break one or more of the small bones in your hand. He bent down and extracted Nissa's blaster from its holster. "Now stand up." "Well, Mr. Niss," came another voice, "do as you are told and stand up." D.G. Bailey was standing at their side, beard bristling, face slightly flushed, but his voice was dangerously calm. "You four," he said, "hand me your sidearms one at a time. Come on, move a little faster. 1, 2, 3, 4. Now continue to stand there at attention." "Sir," this to Daniil, "give me that sidearm you are holding." "Good. 5. And now, Mr. Niss, at attention." And he placed the blasters on the ground beside him. Niss stiffened to attention, eyes bloodshot, face contorted in obvious pain. "Would someone," said D.G., "please say what has been going on?" "Captain," said Daniil quickly, "Mr. Niss and I have had a playful altercation. No harm has been done." "Mr. Niss, however, looks somewhat harmed," said D.G.
"No permanent harm, Captain," said Daniil.
"I see. Well, we'll get back to this later. Madam," he turned on his heel to address Gladia, "I don't recall that I gave you permission to emerge from the ship. You will go back to your cabin with your two companions at once. I am captain here, and this is not Aurora. Do as I say."
Daniil placed an apologetic hand on Gladia's elbow. Her chin lifted, but she turned and went up the gangplank and into the ship, Daniil at her side, Giscard following. D.G. then turned to the crewmen.
"You five," he said, his voice never lifting from its flat calm, "come with me. We'll get to the bottom of this or of you."
And he gestured to a petty officer to pick up the sidearms and take them away. 20. D.G. stared at the five grimly. He was in his own quarters, the only portion of the ship that had a semblance of size to it and the beginnings of an appearance of luxury. He said, pointing to each in turn, "Now, this is the way we'll work it. You tell me exactly what happened, word for word, motion for motion. When you're finished, you tell me anything that was wrong or left out. Then you the same, then you, and then I'll get to you, Miss. I expect that you were all out of order, that you all did something unusually stupid that earned you all, but especially Niss, considerable humiliation. If, in your story, it would appear that you did nothing wrong and suffered no humiliation, then I'll know you're lying, especially as the spacer woman will surely tell me what happened, and I intend to believe every word she says. A lie will make matters worse for you than anything you've actually done. Now," he barked, "start."
The first crewman stumbled hastily through the story, and then the second, somewhat correcting, somewhat expanding, then the third and the fourth. D.G. listened, stony-faced, to the recital, then motioned Bertram Niss to one side. He spoke to the other four.
"And while Niss was getting his face rightly mashed into the dirt by the spacer, what were you four doing? Watching? Scared to move? All four of you against one man?"
One of the men broke the thickening silence to say,
"It all happened so quick, Captain. We were just getting set to move in, and then it was all over."
"And what were you getting ready to do, in case you did manage to get to move someday?"
"Well, we were going to pull the spacer foreigner off our mate."
"Do you think you could have?"
This time no one offered to make a sound. D.G. leaned toward them.
"Now, here's the situation. You had no business interfering with a foreigner, so you're fined 1 week's pay each. And now let's get something straight. If you tell what has happened to anyone else, in the crew or out, now or ever, whether drunk or sober, you'll be broken, every one of you, to apprentice shipper. It doesn't matter which one of you talks, you'll all four be broken, so keep an eye on each other. Now get to your assigned tasks, and if you cross me at any time during this voyage, if you so much as hiccup against regulations, you'll be in the brig."
The four left, mournful, hangdog, tight-lipped. Niss remained, a bruise developing on his face, his arms clearly in discomfort. D.G. regarded him with a threatening quiet, while Niss stared to the left, to the right, at his feet, everywhere but at the face of the captain.
It was only when Nissa's eyes, running out of evasion, caught the glare of the captain that D.G. said, "Well, you look very handsome, now that you have tangled with a sissy spacer half your size. Next time you better hide when one of them shows up."
"Yes, Captain," said Nis, miserably.
"Did you or did you not, Nis, hear me in my briefing, before we left Aurora, say that the spacer woman and her companions were on no account to be disturbed or spoken to?"
"Captain, I only wanted a polite howdy-do. We was curious for a closer look. No harm meant."
"You meant no harm? You asked how old she was. Was that your business?"
"Just curious. Wanted to know."
"One of you made a sexual suggestion."
"Not me, Captain."
"Someone else? Did you apologize for it?"
"To a spacer?"
Nis sounded horrified. "Certainly. You were going against my orders."
"I meant no harm,"
said Nis doggedly. "You meant no harm to the man?" "He put his hand on me, Captain." "I know he did. Why?"
"Because he was ordering me around."
"And you wouldn't stand for it?"
"Would you, Captain?"
"All right, then, you didn't stand for it. You fell down for it, right on your face. How did that happen?"
"I don't rightly know, Captain. He was fast, like the camera was sped up, and he had a grip like iron."
D.G. said,
"So he did.
What did you expect, you idiot? He is iron."
"Captain?"
"Nis, is it possible you don't know the story of Elijah Bailey?"
Nis rubbed his ear in embarrassment.
"I know he's your great-something grandfather, Captain."
"Yes, everyone knows that from my name. Have you ever viewed his life story?"
"I'm not a viewing man, Captain. Not on history."
He shrugged, and as he did so, winced, and made as though to rub his shoulder, then decided he didn't quite dare do so.
"Did you ever hear of R. Daniil Olivaw?"
Nis squeezed his brows together.
"He was Elijah Bailey's friend."
"Yes, he was. You do know something, then. Do you know what the R stands for in R. Daniil Olivaw?"
"It stands for robot, right? He was a robot friend. There was robots on Earth in them days."
"There were, Nis, and still are. But Daniil wasn't just a robot. He was a spacer robot who looked like a spacer man."
"Think about it, Nis. Guess who the spacer man you picked a fight with really was?"
Nis's eyes widened, his face reddened dully.
"You mean that spacer was a
That was R. Daniil Olivaw."
"But, Captain, that was 200 years ago."
"Yes. And the spacer woman was a particular friend of my ancestor Elijah. She's been alive for 233 years, in case you still want to know. And do you think a robot can't do as well as that? You were trying to fight a robot, you great fool."
"Why didn't it say so?"
Nis said with great indignation.
"Why should it? Did you ask? See here, Nis, you heard what I told the others about telling this to anyone. It goes for you, too, but much more so. They are only crewmen, but I had my eye on you for crew leader. Had my eye on you. If you're going to be in charge of the crew, you've got to have brains and not just muscle. So now it's going to be harder for you, because you're going to have to prove you have brain, against my firm opinion that you don't."
"Captain, I..."
"Don't talk. Listen. If this story gets out, the other four will be apprentice shippers, but you will be nothing. You will never go on shipboard again. No ship will take you. I promise you that. Not as crew, not as passenger. Ask yourself what kind of money you can make on Bailey World, and doing what? That's if you talk about this, or if you cross the spacer woman in any way, or even just look at her for more than half a second at a time, or at her two robots. And you are going to have to see to it that no one else among the crew is in the least offensive. You're responsible, and you're fined 2 weeks' pay."
"But, Captain," said Nis weakly,
"the others..."
"I expected less from the others, Nis, so I fined them less. Get out of here."
21. D.G. played idly with the photocube that always stood on his desk. Each time he turned it, it blackened, then cleared when stood upon one of its sides as its base.
When it cleared, the smiling three-dimensional image of a woman's head could be seen. Crew rumor was that each of the six sides led to the appearance of a different woman. The rumor was quite correct. Jaminoser watched the flashing appearance and disappearance of images totally without interest. Now that the ship was secured, or as secured as it could be, against attack of any expected variety, it was time to think of the next step. DG, however, was approaching the matter obliquely, or perhaps not approaching it at all. He said, "It was the woman's fault, of course." Oser shrugged and passed his hand over his beard, as though he were reassuring himself that he, at least, was not a woman. Unlike DG, Oser had his upper lip luxuriantly covered as well. DG said, "Apparently, being on the planet of her birth removed any thought of discretion. She left the ship, even though I had asked her not to." "You might have ordered her not to." "I don't know that that would have helped. She's a spoiled aristocrat, used to having her own way and to ordering her robots about. Besides, I plan to use her, and I want her cooperation, not her pouting. And, again, she was the ancestor's friend."
"And still alive," said Oser, shaking his head.
"It makes the skin crawl. An old, old woman." "I know, but she looks quite young. Still attractive. And nose in the air. Wouldn't retire when the crewmen approached, wouldn't shake hands with one of them. Well, it's over." "Still, Captain, was it the right thing to tell Ness he had tackled a robot?" "Had to. Had to, Oser, if he thought he'd been beaten and humiliated before four of his mates by an effeminate spacer half his size. He'd be useless to us forever. It would have broken him completely. And we don't want anything to happen that will start the rumor that spacers, that human spacers, are supermen. That's why I had to order them so strenuously not to talk about it. Nis will ride herd on all of them, and if it does get out, it will also get out that the spacer was a robot. But I suppose there was a good side to the whole thing."
"Where, Captain?" asked Oser.
"It got me to thinking about robots. How much do we know about them? How much do you know?"
Oser shrugged.
"Captain, it's not something I think about much. Or something anyone else thinks about, either. At least any settler. We know that the spacers have robots, depend on them, go nowhere without them, can't do a thing without them, are parasites on them, and we're sure they're fading away because of them. We know that Earth once had robots forced on them by the spacers, and that they are gradually disappearing from Earth, and are not found at all in Earth cities, only in the countryside. We know that the settler worlds don't, and won't, have them anywhere, town or country. So settlers never meet them on their own worlds, and hardly ever on Earth."
His voice had a curious inflection each time he said Earth, as though one could hear the capital, as though one could hear the words home and mother whispered behind it.
"What else do we know?"
Oser said,
"There's the three laws of robotics."
"Right." DG pushed the photocube to one side and leaned forward.
"Especially the first law. A robot may not injure a human being, or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. Yes? Well, don't rely on it. It doesn't mean a thing. We all feel ourselves to be absolutely safe from robots because of that, and that's fine if it gives us confidence, but not if it gives us false confidence. Our Daniil injured Nis, and it didn't bother the robot at all, first law or no first law."
"He was defending..."
"Exactly. What if you must balance injuries? What if it was a case of either hurtness or allow your spacer owner to come to harm? Naturally, she comes first."
"It makes sense."
"Of course it does. And here we are on a planet of robots, a couple of 100 million of them. What orders do they have? How do they balance the conflict between different harms? How can we be sure that none of them will touch us? Something on this planet has destroyed 2 ships already."
Oser said uneasily,
"This R. Daniil is an unusual robot. Looks more like a man than we do. It may be we can't generalize from him. That other robot, what's his name?"
"Giscard. It's easy to remember. My name is Daniil Giscard."
"I think of you as Captain, Captain. Anyway, that R. Giscard just stood there and didn't do a thing. He looks like a robot, and he acts like one.
We've got lots of robots out there on Solaria watching us right now, and they're not doing a thing either. Just watching. And if there are some special robots that can harm us, I think we're prepared for them. Now we are. That's why the incident with Daniil and Nis was a good thing. We've been thinking that we can only be in trouble if some of the Solarians are still here. They don't have to be. They can be gone. It may be that the robots, or at least some specially designed robots, can be dangerous. And if Lady Gladia can mobilize her robots in this place, it used to be her estate, and make them defend her and us too, we may well be able to neutralize anything they've left behind. Can she do that? Said Oser. We're going to see, said D.G. 22.
Thank you, Daniil, Gladia said. You did well. Her face seemed pinched together, however. Her lips were thin and bloodless, her cheeks pale. Then, in a lower voice, I wish I had not come.
Giscard said, It is a useless wish, Madame Gladia. Friend Daniil and I will remain outside the cabin to make sure you are not further disturbed. The corridor was empty and remained so, but Daniil and Giscard managed to speak in sound-wave intensities below the human threshold, exchanging thoughts in their brief and condensed way. Giscard said, Madame Gladia made an injudicious decision in refusing to retire. That is clear. I presume, friend Giscard, said Daniil, that there was no possibility of maneuvering her into changing that decision. It was far too firm, friend Daniil, and taken too quickly. The same was true of the intention of Nis, the settler. Both his curiosity concerning Madame Gladia and his contempt and animosity toward you were too strong to manage without serious mental harm. The other four I could handle. It was quite possible to keep them from intervening. Their astonishment at your ability to handle this froze them naturally, and I had only to strengthen that slightly. That was fortunate, friend Giscard. Had those four joined Mr. Nis, I would have been faced with the difficult choice of forcing Madame Gladia into a humiliating retreat, or of badly damaging one or two of the settlers to frighten off the rest. I think I would have had to choose the former alternative, but it too would have caused me grave discomfort. You are well, friend Daniil? Quite well. My damage to Mr. Nis was minimal. Physically, friend Daniil, it was. Within his mind, however, there was great humiliation, which was to him much worse than the physical damage. Since I could sense that, I could not have done what you did so easily. And yet, friend Daniil? Yes, friend Giscard. I am disturbed over the future. On Aurora, through all the decades of my existence, I have been able to work slowly, to wait for opportunities of touching minds gently without doing harm, of strengthening what is already there, of weakening what is already attenuated, of pushing gently in the direction of existing impulse. Now, however, we are coming to a time of crisis in which emotions will run high, decisions will be taken quickly, and events will race past us. If I am to do any good at all, I will have to act quickly, too, and the three laws of robotics prevent me from doing so. It takes time to weigh the subtleties of comparative physical and mental harm. Had I been alone with Madame Gladia at the time of the settlers' approach, I do not see what course I could have taken that I would not have recognized as entailing serious damage to Madame Gladia, to one or more of the settlers, to myself, or possibly to all who were involved. Daniil said, What is there to do, friend Giscard? Since it is impossible to modify the three laws, friend Daniil, once again we must come to the conclusion that there is nothing we can do but await failure.